Blog Talk Radio.
Well, happy new year, everybody, and welcome to 2019 on the Yaron Brooks Show. I'm excited. I'm excited for the next year. I'm excited for what we are going to be doing together. I have a whole year kind of laid out already. Roland is saying happy new year from Amsterdam. I'm coming to Amsterdam. In March. So I've got a whole program, a whole year laid out in terms of my travel schedule. I'm going to be doing tons of events all over the world as usual. Hopefully more in the United States. Right now I've got a heavy schedule in the UK, in Europe, in Asia. We'll be going to Asia. I'm looking, those of you in Japan, South Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Mongolia, and possibly China. We'll be doing a tour over there this year. We'll be really all over the place. Talks at Ocon, at FEE, at a bunch of universities, a bunch of conferences. So a really, really heavy and heavy schedule already laid out. A potential very exciting debate series with a socialist yet to be identified that'll have, very high profile, I think, also tentatively scheduled for later this year. And I think you'll see a series of events and a series of shows with Dave Rubin. So a number of things with Dave Rubin and potentially with members of the intellectual dark web. So I think a lot of exciting stuff to look forward to. I think the next talk I'll be giving is at the University of Texas in Austin. So look for that on the 23rd of January. That'll be the first public talk I'll be giving in this year. Oh, Unshelled Coast says he got accepted to Clemson. Oh, right. Fantastic. You've got to look up my good friend Bradley Thompson and the Center for Capitalism at Clemson University. That is terrific. Very, very exciting for you. And I'm, of course, affiliated. I'm on the board of the Center for Capitalism at Clemson University. So, as I said, a very detailed year, a lot planned, a lot to look forward to. Of course, if you would like to bring me to campus, or if you would like to bring me to speak to a business or to a professional group or to anything else, write to me, Yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. Very easy, Yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. So if you have a venue that you can arrange for me, don't send me recommendations. Don't send me emails saying, hey, why don't you speak at the University of California? I'm looking for people who can actually make it happen. Right? It's expensive. It's getting more expensive. It's about $4,000 to get me to come and speak. We can, I guess, negotiate under certain conditions, but generally $4,000 a pop. Adam is asking about a debate with Shapiro. God. His God, I guess, not my God. I don't know what we're going to be able to do with Shapiro. He keeps saying he wants to do it. He keeps telling me he wants to do it. He, puts me onto his people. And then his people basically make it impossible to do it. So I don't know if it's him or if it's multiple producers and handlers and people who deal with a Ben Shapiro brand. But they obviously, somebody there is preventing this from happening. So we'll keep trying. We'll keep trying to put on something with Shapiro. My goal ideally would be to go on his Sunday show. But even though he said he'd invite me, the invitation has not arrived yet. So, as I said, I will keep at it and keep making the effort to get on there. We will see. But I think with Dave Rubin, you'll see some exciting stuff happening over the next year. So multiple events, multiple appearances, and some debate format kind of structures with other intellectuals. So, we'll see. It's still yet to be determined the exact format and the dates, but we are definitely working on it. We will also see big changes in 2019, I think, in terms of how you support this show. And again, thank you for everything you've done in 2018. Thank you for all the support. It's been amazing to see how many of you have stepped up and helped make this show possible. And some of you with some significant contributions, significant support. So thank you. And I hope you continue into the next year. We will be leaving Patreon at some point. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And we'll be finding an alternative platform. Dave Rubin and Jordan Peterson, as I predicted, are now saying it's going to take a little while before they have that alternative ready. They are leaving. Both of them are leaving Patreon on January 15th, but they are not committing to when they'll have an alternative platform available. In the meantime, Subscribestar is basically, you know, going nowhere. I'm looking at some Bitcoin alternatives, but I know that a lot of you are not very proficient with Bitcoin, so it's not really a solution for everybody. It's a solution for some. So the search goes on for an alternative to Patreon, and we will provide that alternative. In the meantime, of course, you can support me on paypal.me, and it's pretty straightforward there. Somebody says Sargon is saying that Subscribestar has almost fixed their problem. Great. I mean, I'm all set on Subscribestar. Everything is ready. All they need is to turn on the switch. And as soon as they solve their problems and turn on the switch, we will shift to Subscribestar. And then we will also shift to whatever else we can, including some kind of cryptocurrency solution. So we will definitely adopt a cryptocurrency solution as well. Also, and here's a request for you guys who are listening. I'm looking for somebody who is proficient with, with WordPress. Somebody who's proficient with WordPress. I'm willing, you know, I'll pay for your time, obviously. But what I need is somebody who can significantly improve my website, primarily automatize certain tasks that right now need to be manual. And secondly, create a subscribe page on WordPress. I don't think it's that hard. I think there's a module in WordPress that makes it possible to put up a payment page and maybe even include Bitcoin as a possibility to use as a payment mechanism. So if any of you are a WordPress programmer or interested, you know, somebody is good, somebody who this would be quick and easy for and who I'm willing to pay for, you know, write to me. Yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. Yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. I think WordPress is, I think there are a lot of you probably are pretty proficient with it. So two things. One is improve the site, automatize certain of the parts of it, and then just use the plugin that's available with WordPress and just create a page for me where we can take contributions and also take maybe Bitcoin and ideally have kind of a subscription service on there. So anybody out there proficient with WordPress and is interested in making a little bit of money on the side, contact me, yaron@yaronbrookshow.com. Get an app. I'm not sure what that means. All right. Good. So I think that brings us up in terms of contribution. Again, thank you all of you for having made this show possible for the last year. And I'm pretty excited about where we're heading in the next year. I'm hoping a lot of things are going to be improved, professionalized. And you're seeing, I think, a short video coming out every day. We're going to be doing, I'm hoping that's literally every day we will have a short video come out. On a different topic, and those I've already got enough now to think to roll for the next 10 days. I'm hoping that'll be a continuous thing, a short video and then a show, on, you know, every other day or whenever I can do it. Of course. Action Jackson wants everyone to super chat $1 with the word yes. If you want Yaron to do a show on the good things Trump has done. This might make the hair on the back of his neck stand up. You can do it. I'm happy to do a show on the good things Trump has done, but I will never do a show on only the good things Trump has done, because I think that is completely non-objective. And I think it's completely, it's non-objective and it's wrong. I think when somebody does good things for the wrong reasons, when somebody does good things, but the bad things outweigh the good things, if somebody does good things, but his persona and his attitude and everything else bode very, very badly for the future of America, you can't just list the good things that they do. By the way, I've often listed the good things Donald Trump has done, or people within his administration have done. Let's see how many people are going to put a dollar to support me doing a show and all the good things. I have a feeling, Action Jackson, there are not going to be that many takers on the chat, although you could probably round them up. There's a bunch of Trump supporters who usually troll me here that you could probably round up on YouTube and bring them over to support that. But I will be taking Super Chat questions today, so feel free to use that as another mechanism to support the show, particularly you, those of you who maybe are not supporting the show on Patreon. It's been terrific over the last few episodes. Some substantial money, I mean, not really, but substantial money in relative terms, has come in over the last few shows that I've done through the Super Chat. It's compensated for the pretty significant losses I've taken on Patreon as people have abandoned the platform. Also, some of you have gone over to paypal.me and contributed there, so thank you for that. That is greatly appreciated. Contributions there have also skyrocketed, again, as a consequence of the fact that people are dropping Patreon. So all in, I think we're break even and maybe even growing again. So that's all good. So thank you again for all of that support. I didn't do a show this year about 2018 and lessons learned. I don't know. It seemed a little too depressing. I might still do something about that, prioritizing them. But we'll talk a little bit about that today as we talk about what I think the real big issues are looking into 2019, what to be focused on, what I think the dangers and what are the hopes are for 2019. But I think the first thing and the most important thing I'm going to say today, and this is so important on New Year's, is New Year's is a great time to really forget about the politics and forget about the world out there. And, the political world, the economic world, the free speech, all the garbage that happens on a day-to-day basis. And it really is a time to think about your own life. It's a time to really focus on your own values and your own life and what's most important to you. And what do you want to do with 2019, with this new year, in advancing your goals, in advancing your values, in achieving and attaining your values. So I think this is a great period of time. I think the period between Christmas and New Year, and maybe a few days after New Year, to really commit yourself to thinking and to really thinking about what's important. What am I going to do in the next year to make my life more meaningful, to make my life more substantial, to make my life the best life that it can be, and to really elevate my game, the game of living. How am I going to be better pursue my values in my career? How am I going to better pursue my values, my romantic values? How am I better going to pursue my values in every dimension and every aspect in our lives? Now, we all focus in on, I want to lose 5 pounds. I want to exercise more. And that's all good. But at the end of the day, exercise and weight and things like that, I mean, they're important. Health is crucial. It's important. But they're much bigger, more important things to focus on. These should be the relatively easy stuff. Yeah, go exercise. Don't need a New Year's resolution for that. You know, lose some weight. Watch what you eat, you know, diet, whatever. These are not big issues. The big issues is, what do I do to make my romantic relationship better? What do I do to establish a romantic relationship if I don't have one? How do I make my job the best job in the world? Or how do I advance to attain the job that I really want from where I am today? These are the really big questions. And then how do I make myself a better person? And here, let me just recommend that every year you spend time with the virtue of selfishness. Ayn Rand's books, Ayn Rand's essay, The Objectivist Ethic. Because in the virtue of selfishness, in that first essay, The Objectivist Ethics, is the guide, is the map for how to improve your life, how to make your life better, how to live the best life that you can be. The virtues that articulated, the seven virtues that articulated in that book, they need a lot of work. You need to do a lot of work with them. You need to chew them and absorb them and analyze them and apply them and learn and constantly improve on how they apply to your life, and specifically how they apply to your life and how they apply to your values. But they are the bedrock. They are what is going to make your life better in 2019. So what is, instead of focusing on just the concretes, this is a great time to go to the fundamentals, to go to the moral principles that are going to apply to everything you do in your life, including going on the treadmill and dieting and, you know, pursuing your romantic relationships and everything else. All right, we got somebody from Exeter, my favorite university. Hey, Matthew, it's great to have somebody from Exeter on. One of my regular gigs now, right? 5 years in a row, is it? I think it's 5 years in a row. So really, focusing on the objectivist ethics, focusing on the virtues, and figuring out in detail how they apply to your life and how you can apply them to your life and how you can use them. They are tools. They are tools. They're the most important, crucial tools you have in your toolbox for making your life better. Get away from the television. Get away from politics. And this is going to be, it's going to be quite a year politically. I mean, the Democrats are going to choose a presidential candidate. You probably saw Elizabeth Warren has already thrown a hat in the ring. Oh my God, what a disaster. And it's going to be an awful year because Democrats are going to go after Trump and Trump is going to lash out at everybody. And it's just going to be horrible. It's just going to be horrible. You know, Democrats and Republicans are going to try to get together to regulate the internet. There might be a recession late in the year. Free speech, or at least our ability to speak up, is being curtailed through activism from the left that is applying pressure on all these corporations. It's going to be a tough year. Focus on your values. Get away from the politics. You can't affect the politics anyway. I mean, I can't affect the politics, and I do this for a living. You can't affect the politics anyway. What you can affect is the life you live. What you can't affect is the things that you do on a day-to-day basis. What you can't affect is, do you surround yourself with beauty or not? Do you make your life a happy, prosperous, successful, thoughtful life or not? That's what you can affect. And that's what you should be focusing on in this new year. Focusing on your life, focusing on being selfish, being a real egoist, really figuring out fully and comprehensively what's good for you, what's going to make your life the best that it can be. And it's work. It's work. It's not trivial. It's not easy to figure that out. But again, the good, best start in the world is to pick up and reread, and certainly if you haven't read it before, The Objectivist Ethics by Ayn Rand, and then chew on it. You can read Tara Smith's Viable Values. We're going to have Tara Smith on the show in a couple of weeks. You can read OPA, but read the sections on ethics, particularly OPA and Tara's, where they really chew on the ethics and make yourself better. And then apply it. Figure out how to apply it to every aspect and every part of your life, right? And we'll try to help you here in a sense that I'll go back and start doing more episodes on the virtues. I know I've done some, but I'll do more. I'll repeat some. I know this is kind of stuff that's good to chew on and repeat and chew on constantly because it's so easy to get away from it. Somebody here mentioned Gina Golan. She's also going to be on the show in the next few weeks, as is Mark Pellegrino. We're going to have Mark Pellegrino on the show next week. So we're going to have Gina. We're going to have Mark. We're going to have Tara, hopefully all in January. So we're going to resurrect the – not resurrect, but continue my interview series with Objectivist Intellectuals. And hopefully you've all enjoyed. And we're gonna you know, have some great, great interviews in the coming year. Stefan wants me to talk about metaphysics more. I don't get that. I don't get what's so interesting about metaphysics. I find metaphysics really, really, really boring. You know, metaphysics is basically reality is what it is. It's a law of identity. A is A. We have consciousness that perceives perceives reality. And the law of causality. And I know it's much more complicated than that, but just I find it uninteresting. The things I find, and epistemology is more interesting, but really, really hard. And I don't know, you know, I'm not an expert on it. What I find interesting is ethics and politics. Those are the things that I find interesting in philosophy. I find metaphysics... I find it boring. I know the people, it's all they study. I think epistemology would be fun and really interesting, but it's not my field. ITOE is Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology. And of course, a lot of the work that there's been a lot of work done in epistemology and objectivism, but it's not my field. I'm interested in how to live your life and the kind of things that are necessary to live your life. Somebody mentioned that they miss the other part of Ayn Rand's philosophy that I really love and I want to get back into this year is her aesthetics. So I'm going to, because, you know, this is the 50th anniversary to the Romantic Manifesto. I intend to spend more time on her aesthetics this year. I plan to reread the Romantic Manifesto. OCON, the Objectivist Conference this year, is going to be about the Romantic Manifesto. I'll be giving at least one talk there. And so I think aesthetics will play a bigger role in this year's programming of the Iran Book Show, so giving the 50 years of Romantic Manifesto. So I'm ready to recommend another show. Last show I think I recommended was Mr. Sunshine. I highly, highly recommend that. I hope you guys watch it. I know that somebody mentioned, I think maybe it's even Harry Binswanger mentioned that they couldn't follow the first episode. And yeah, the first episode is very hard to follow. It sets all the background, it sets the context, and it's in Korean. And you know, for some of us, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to differentiate the characters when they're all Asian. But, you know, you have to get used to it. You have to work on it. So you maybe have to watch the episode twice, so you have to slow down and watch it slowly. But it's definitely worth watching, Mr. Sunshine. But I'll recommend one other show in a little while. Action Jackson, I asked your thought on Elizabeth Warren run for president. I mean, I think it's great for me because there'll be tons to talk about. I think Elizabeth Warren will run a much more philosophical campaign, much more radical campaign. She's a much more committed leftist, committed kind of fascist leftist than anybody else. She's more intellectual than Obama was, and Obama was fun because he was intellectual. So she will be fun to go after. She'll be fun to criticize. She is an unmitigated disaster. The only way Elizabeth Warren could win is because Trump so destroys the Republican brand, so destroys Republican politics that he leaves the door wide open for Elizabeth I. But you know, if it wasn't for Trump, I don't think she'd have a chance in hell to win this. I still think the Democrats are going to vote for somebody more centrist, but it's going to be interesting. The other thing that might happen is if she runs and Bernie runs and one or two other real progressives run, then that the vote might be diluted, which will allow a centrist to dominate. But who that is, I have no idea. But Elizabeth Warren is going to make it interesting. It's going to make it fun. She has real proposals, which are really, 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 really bad. Some of the worst proposals possible. But she's intellectual. She's smart. She's a law professor. A lot of the ideas the famous Obama speech, my favorite of all Obama speeches in terms of its philosophical impact and how much it reveals about Obama's soul, was that you didn't build that speech. And that whole concept was Elizabeth Warren had articulated a few months earlier, and he basically stole it from her. So she's going to do a lot of that kind of stuff, and that's great for people like me. All right, Time Warp, $50. I bet I have an answer for this one. Why should we encourage objectivist intellectuals to go into academia? Good question. Why should we want virtuous people in evil institutions that will only corrupt them? Charles II has been more effective as an intellectual than any objectivist in academia today. All right, a lot of assertions there, particularly the last one, is complete and utter nonsense. To a large extent, because you just, what does that mean? What does it mean effective? Effective with regard to whom? How many people has Charles II touched? How many people has Charles II changed their minds? To what extent has Charles II made objectivism more? And this is not a criticism of Charles. This is just a criticism of whoever's asking the question. He might be fantastic, but really, how many people has he touched? So no question in my mind that somebody like Alan Gotthelf, who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, was far more effective as an intellectual. And it, what do you mean by effective as an intellectual? But in terms of getting the word out, in terms of converting people, if we want to use that terminology, in terms of legitimizing objectivism in the world out there, in terms of the debate and the discussion, far more than Charles is. And I'm convinced, I have no doubt, that that is true today of people like Greg Salamieri, who is in academia, at least partially in academia, and Tara Smith and other objectivists in academia. How do you measure how effective an intellectual can be? Maybe Charles II has done an extraordinary job, maybe, in explaining certain ideas about objectivism to people who are already interested. Maybe that's a lot of you guys. But how do you measure the effectiveness of intellectual? This is what I find about the Charles II phenomena. And this is to say nothing about Charles, put Charles aside. Again, I have nothing against Charles, but I find that the people who are his advocates do him, I think, an injustice by making him out to be, the savior of objectivism, and by making him out to be, the most effective objectivist intellectual in the world today or whatever. I think you're doing him injustice. I don't think it's right. I don't think it's just. I don't think it's just to Charles. I don't think it's just to anybody else to set that. Now, if he is saying that about himself, then he's delusional and that's his problem. But you guys who are his fans, if you're not objective about him, you are doing him no favors. And that is not an objective statement about Charles. And unfortunately, a lot of the people asking me questions about Charles are just not objective about it. And he might be phenomenal at answering the questions and explaining objectivist ideas and criticizing me and criticizing other objectivists and criticizing Jordan Peterson. I mean, he might be, but to make these claims about a 20-something-year-old is just not, you know, who's been doing this for maybe a year or two or whatever, is just, you know, really, it's just sad, right? It's sad. By the way, let's answer the question, because he did put $50 on it, and I appreciate Time Warp support, and he has supported through, at least I know through Super Chat, he supported a lot of my programs and is a supporter of the show. Why should we encourage objectivist intellectuals to go in academia? Because whether we like it or not, academia is still the most influential institution in our society. It is still where most people get their intellectual training. It is where most people who ultimately are influential in a culture, it is where most people who are influential in a culture get exposed to philosophical ideas. It is where most people who land up being influential in the culture get exposed to ideas, to ways of thinking. It's where they're being trained. So everybody today, from Donald Trump on, blames the state of the world on the media. Now, why is the media so corrupt? Why is the media so bad? Because they've been trained that way by academia. They've been trained that way because they all went to school. They went to good schools. They took the right classes. They were indoctrinated with a certain set of ideas. And that is true both on the left and on the right. So if you look, who are the most influential intellectuals on the right today? I mean, you can start with Jordan Peterson, who is an academic. But then go on through all the other intellectuals on the right, the neoconservatives, not the good ones, the bad ones, all the ones on the right. They're either all in academia, or they're heavily influenced by people who are in academia who share their points of view. So academia is this unique institution where you get exposure as a professor to hundreds of students. You get exposure to other professors who you can influence to make them better, and they have access to thousands of students. And not students who are coming on YouTube and casually engaging with ideas, but students who for a period in their life, 4 years, or if they're graduate students for longer, are focused on intellectual pursuits, are focused on figuring out the world out there. And at their most open period in their life, when they're open to new ideas, where they are, it's possible to influence them. And indeed, the left does an amazing job at influences, or the right, if they go to some universities where they're influenced by the right. So here is a group of people who want ideas, who are committed to spending time engaged with ideas, and you want to give up on those people. You want to leave them to the enemies of reason and the enemies of capitalism. And I say no. We will not win the battle unless we win the battle, the academic battle. Now, it is true that with the web, ultimately, academia will be disrupted and a new model would arise. And I don't know what that new model would arise, but it will be some form of online education. And maybe YouTube is the beginning of that, kind of YouTube courses. And it's why the Ironman Institute is putting so much material up on YouTube, all of Leonard Peikoff's courses, all of Ayn Rand's lectures, all of Leonard's lectures, a huge amount of material where you can actually study objectivism, not just get somebody to answer a question for you, but actually study it in detail, which is what Leonard Peikoff courses provide you. And all of those courses are going to be ultimately on YouTube available for you. And all of them are already on the Ayn Rand website, on campus website, where you can listen to everything Leonard Peikoff has done. Somebody mentioned John Ridpath, and yeah, John Ridpath influenced hundreds of people, possibly thousands of people. So again, comparing Charles Chu to John Ridpath, I mean, and I'm not comparing them as intellectuals, as the quality of what they say, but just in terms of, as you say, influence, a effectiveness, whatever effectiveness means. I don't know what effectiveness means in this. I mean, I have a concept of what effectiveness means, but what do you mean in terms of effectiveness? So I think academia is still incredibly important. And look, this is part of the question, and this is where I probably disagree with Charles, and I disagree maybe with some of you. And I, you know, and this is a debate we have at the Institute, and a debate we have in the board of directors, and a debate we have among objectivists, and we'll continue to have it for a long, long time. What are we trying to do? How do you change a culture is the question. Do you change a culture by creating objectivists? Do you change a culture by what? Now, I have a view of this, which involves educating objectivists, creating objectivists, training objectivists. You have to do that. And that's going to be important. And many of those people, some of those people, the most important part of that is that some of those people become intellectuals. But what do those intellectuals do? They train more objectivists. I mean, at the end of the day, the world will never be majority objectivist. Objectivists will always be, I think, objectivist in terms of people who really know the philosophy inside out. Just like the world today is Kantian without people knowing Kant. Or like the world today, America today is Christian without most of the people having read the New Testament. So, all right. So, what are you trying to do? I mean, my view is you're trying to bring objectivist ideas beyond training objectivists, which you have to do. Bring objectivist ideas into the culture. Make them a part of the culture. Make them something that is debated in the culture. And if they're the right ideas, if they're the good ideas, and if enough intellectuals ultimately provide an intellectual leadership, then the culture will change. But the culture, when the culture changes, it doesn't change just because some philosophers say something new. That philosophy has to be integrated into people's lives at some level. So the art gets better, the movies get better, the sculpture gets better, the educational system gets better. It doesn't go all out objectivists, but it just gets better. Science, the philosophy of science gets better, and therefore science gets better. The objectivist ideas get applied in a variety of different areas, in a variety of different forms, in ways that make the world a better place, and in ways in which people start identifying, oh, that's Ayn Rand's influence on this. It's not that all the people who are influenced by Ayn Rand become objectivists. No, they won't, and they never will. And the goal is not to do that. And this is why I think it's stupid. It's stupid. It's counterproductive to be obnoxious to other intellectuals. Your goal is not to convert those intellectuals into objectivists. Your goal is not to convince the audience to become objectivists. Your goal is to plant some seeds of these ideas in the mind of the other intellectual so that they view Ayn Rand with greater respect, maybe even take seriously some of her ideas and apply them and talk about them. Plant that seed in the mind of the people who admire this intellectual, so that they then go read Ayn Rand or take her ideas more seriously or apply her ideas in a new way. It's to inspire that future sculptor, that future scriptwriter, that future scientist to look at Ayn Rand's ideas. And again, they might never become an objectivist. They might never accept the entirety of her ideas. Very few people will. It's to influence them, to make them better people. It's to make them better actors within the culture. And if you can do that to hundreds of thousands, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions, the world will change. And then one day, everybody will be an objectivist and I'll just take it for granted. But that's a long time coming. Long time coming. It's going to take a long time to happen. And in the meantime, we need to work to make the culture better, to make the world out there better, to make people, individuals, better. And a big part of that is you need a model, better behavior. But a big piece of that is we need people in academia. Now, one aspect of academia I didn't address, and that is academia gives you, in the world in which we live, academia gives you status. It puts you on television. I mean, look at Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson would be nothing if he couldn't cite academic papers, if he hadn't published academic papers, if he didn't have a PhD after his name, if he, you know, that is what gives him the status. But it's not just the status. Here's a guy with, you know, who has spent his life researching these questions, thinking about these questions, writing about these questions, publishing about these questions, influencing the thinking in his field about these questions. And therefore, people respect him. And that's why he gets a lot of the opportunities that he got in order to establish his massive base that he has today. But that's true of almost everybody. There are a few exceptions, like Sam Harris, who did it outside of academia. But almost everybody else is ultimately, who's real influential, either gets it from academia or is in academia themselves. The most important ethicists who influence the world today, I mean badly, are academics. They write, they publish, they do lectures, they go on YouTube, they do all the stuff. But they're academics. People read their stuff, and people engage in their ideas. And we need objectivist academics. We need dozens of them and dozens of them. We need to be in the one institution in the world dedicated to ideas, not to entertainment, which is ultimately what YouTube is dedicated to, but dedicated to ideas. So, and you know, imagine if there was an objectivist Steven Pinker. You know, maybe Gina Golan will be the objectivist Steven Pinker. Imagine if there was an objectivist, great objectivist economist in academia today. That's what we need. That's what's going to change the world. You can have all kinds of YouTube personalities, and you know, that's good. I'm not against it. I think it's great. But to really leverage, to get the leverage, to get the impact on millions, to get the impact on not just the people who basically agree with you, but to get the impact on people who don't agree with you, and to get an impact in a field, what we need is we need specialists, we need economists and psychologists and historians and political scientists who are in academia, who are teaching. We need Greg Salamieri's, we need Brad Thompson's, we need Tara Smith's, we need Robert Mayhew's. We need these people. We don't have enough of them. We're way short supply. Now, granted, academia is hard. It's a hard career choice. But you can be successful. You don't have to sell out. You don't have to suffer. You can be very successful in academia. That's not for everybody. And there's a place for a public intellectual like me, like Charles, I guess, like others, either work for the Institute or work independently to promote ideas. But to abandon the most important institution of ideas to evil is a huge mistake. It is a huge mistake. You know. And you have no sense. Every idea that's dominant right now in the culture comes from academia. Every single one of them. And objectivism will not become a dominant set of ideas in the culture unless it has a respectable contingent in academia. So I don't think it's the only thing we should do. I don't think necessarily it's the primary thing we should do, but we should definitely do it. But again, be objective about. All right. Nicholas has a comment. He says he makes a living in a voice, and I always speak at maximum volume as if it's outdoors. A mid-volume, low-volume gear would vastly improve your mic and podcast speaking. Try Vox Coach. Yeah, I think you're right. I yell too much. I don't think I'm that bad, but maybe I am. Maybe right now I'm trying to speak not at max volume, so I assume that's working. I do have a preamp that enhances my volume when I speak softly. So I don't know. Maybe I'm curious whether other people agree with Nicholas and whether I need to I should alter my voice more. I shouldn't just be speaking. I shouldn't just be yelling. And the question is, do I just yell? I need to be more conscious of that. Thanks for the critique. I appreciate that. Keiko asks, what's objectivism view of the TSA, especially domestically? I'm against the TSA objective. I'm against the TSA. I try not to speak for objectivism, but I'm against the TSA. The TSA is a government institution. It should not be having to provide screening of passengers. This is something airlines and airports should be doing. They should be held liable for bad stuff that happens if they don't do their job well. I think the airlines should have been sued after 9/11 and filing for bankruptcy, should have preceded that. I don't think they should have gotten off scot-free from that. They were, so I think they were responsible for security before the TSA. So I don't think the government should be involved in the security. I think it should be private. I think it should be the airlines and the airports responsible for it. And I think it would be better, more efficient, more effective. I mean, ultimately, it is the government responsible for apprehending the terrorists. It is the government responsible for our foreign policy. And of course, here is where I think it's so important that our foreign policy has betrayed us, that has made it necessary to have security at airports. If we had a proper foreign policy, I think security at the airports would be very, very minimal, very, very minimal. So I'm against the TSA as a government organization. I'm against the whole idea of being screened. I'm very much for racial profiling and other forms of profiling for terrorists. I think the Israelis do a much better job of this. But I think at the end of the day, security on airline, making sure that your building is safe, making sure that your airplane is safe, that is the job of the airline and the airport and the particular building. That's why in a lot of buildings in Manhattan, for example, you have to go through security in order to go up the building. And some of them, they used to even be metal detectors. I see fewer and fewer of those these days. I think the same concerts and stuff like that, there's always private security. I think that makes sense. The authority at the end is the police. And it's the government's responsibility to eliminate terrorism and to reduce the threat. But in terms of the actual security at the airports, I think it should be private. Again, it would be 100 times more efficient. I don't know if you guys know about this CLIA, which is a private company that provides, it gets you through security very quickly at the airports. That's an example of how you could do it much more effectively, background checks, much more effectively in a private sector setting, with the risk of liability being, giving you full liability being the downside and the motivation to get it right. Okay, Action Jackson asks, can you guys put intro to objectivist epistemology and honest parallels on Audible, pretty please? I would gladly narrate. I'm surprised they're not on Audible. So objectivist epistemology, introduction to ITOE and ominous parallels. I will look into that and see what's going on with that, because it should be particularly ominous parallels. ITOE, I can see how it's a technical book. Why they might have skipped it, but ominous parallels should be. Andrew asks, what's your opinion of the Foundation of Economic Education, FEE? It's how I originally came across Ayn Rand. What role do you think, if any, non-objectivist free market economics play towards changing the culture? So, I mean, I have a mixed view of FEE. Generally, I'm very friendly towards FEE and sympathetic. They do good work in economic education, particularly for high school students, also college students. I speak, I've spoken at some of their conferences, some of their seminars. I know the previous or the retiring president of FEE has been very friendly towards me and towards Ayn Rand, even though he is quite religious, a religious libertarian. I have the same problem with FEE I have with most libertarian organizations. That is their tolerance, if you will, for anarchists, their tolerance for for a big tent vision of, you know, free market libertarianism. But at the same time, I think they play a crucial role in introducing people to free market ideas. And I do think free market ideas are one of the areas which have to be, people have to be educated about if we're going to change the culture. Now, again, you know, Brian Kaplan, who's a libertarian who I disagree with on a lot of things, who's very critical of Ayn Rand and who is a anarchist, kind of a soft anarchist, wrote a book about ignorant, about voting, right? And he talks about the fact that most people are what he calls rationally ignorant. Most people go about their lives. They have a lot of stuff on their plate. They've got to make a living. They've got to make choices about their life. And most of them just don't know economics. Most of them don't know much about politics. They know very, very little. And since their particular vote, one vote among many, is not going to influence the election, it's not actually going to be the deciding factor in 99.9999999999% of the time. They have no real interest in delving deeply into the political issues. And I think in that sense, they're being completely rational. And I wish we lived in a world in which we didn't have to delve into these political issues. In a rational, objectivist society, you would not think about politics very much. You would not have to know much economics or care much about economics. You would really devote your life, your thought, your energy to figuring out how to live a good life. And the government's job would be to protect you from crooks and criminals, and you would do the everything else would be your responsibility in terms of taking care of your life. But you don't need to know economics to take care of your life. You don't need to have a political view. You know, the candidates would run, but the difference between the candidates would not be that big, and it wouldn't affect your life that much who was in politics or not. And you wouldn't be that interested, and that would be an irrational society. Now, today, unfortunately, who the candidate is, who's president, is very important and has a huge impact on our lives. But people are still behaving as if it doesn't, partially because it's complicated and it's hard, and they're not given tools to deal with it. And life is complex and intense, and they've got a lot to deal with. They're not philosophers, they're not going to be philosophers. And they're just not, they don't pursue it. And I think Brian's, I mean, I don't think the way he quite puts it is right, but I think there's a real point there. So what do people do? Well, they listen to the experts. They listen to Fox and CNN. They read a newspaper. They might read a more philosophical article. They're conditioned to some extent by their philosophy, the implicit philosophy that they've adopted or absorbed from the culture, the implicit philosophy of in the world in which we live in today, Christianity and altruism and the implicit philosophy of Kant, ultimately. But they don't know that. That conditions which intellectuals they listen to and how closely they listen to them and how much of their ideas they adopt from them. And then that's it, right? And in the end of the day, the people who guide the masses, the people who move the masses, the people who are the intellectuals. And this goes back to my point about academia earlier. The intellectuals shape the culture. Now, it's not just the intellectuals in terms of those who deal explicitly with ideas. It also includes the artists, because the artists deal with those ideas implicitly and affect the people who are not actively engaged in thinking about intellectual ideas. Movies can influence them in ways that they might not be able to influence me, because I think through what is the message of the movie and how does that comport with my... Most people don't do that. So it's intellectuals and people who apply intellectual ideas in their work, artists. And, you know, today, it's the screeners and Facebook and Patreon and places like that are also helping shape the culture. But the place in which the masses, for lack of a different word, the majority of people out there, where they get their philosophical inclination, their philosophical views, their political inclination, political views, is basically from the experts, from the intellectuals. And this is why it's so crucial that objectivism be represented among them And to be represented, we have to be in academia. And ultimately, we have to be in the media. And we have to be where people are looking for ideas. And we have to have a voice. How did I get to this? This has got to feed. And I think we need to be representative feed so we can expose young people to these ideas. But I think it's important that objectivists have economics is going to play a big role in this. So here we can find allies. Economics is probably one of the few fields we can find allies who can at least explain the basic economic principles to people. We can at least say, no, look, the minimum wage, it doesn't work that way. Now, that alone is not going to change anything. But that is one more piece of the cultural puzzle that just has to, if we had enough of people saying that, if we had enough experts on television saying it, then people would at least acknowledge that that was an option among options. Today, they just take for granted that raising the minimum wage is a good thing. Because that's the only message they hear. There are almost no real economists explaining on a regular basis on television, in articles, in places, YouTube, why a minimum wage is so disastrous. In the places where, saying this in the places where people actually get their information. So we need free market economists, and to some extent, free market economists are our allies in just bringing rational ideas. And then, of course, if some of them quote Ayn Rand or refer people to Ayn Rand or reference Ayn Rand, that can help. One of the reasons I resent anarchists so much is that I think once people realize that an intellectual is an anarchist, they justifiably dismiss them completely because it's such a stupid idea. And if then they also hear the word Ayn Rand or they hear some good ideas lumped in with it, they dismiss those ideas. Oh, those are the anarchists. They're crazy. That's stupid. So those of you who want to know more about my position on anarchy, there's a video of a debate that I did on the issue in my YouTube account. So in my YouTube channel, you can find it. It's not, from a few weeks ago, we posted it. All right. So I think Fee does a good job on the economic education. We need more people like that doing that kind of education. We need good economic education because that's one of the set of ideas that are going to have to just be changed in order for us to have an impact on the culture. Unfortunately, it would be great if they were all objectivists and they could do it in the context of a philosophical argument and thus make their arguments a lot more effective and a lot more true. They're not. We'll take what we can get. Our job is to come in and fill in the blanks. Bree asks, can we take advantage of the government shutdown to show how useless many government agencies are? I doubt it because the problem is not that people don't know that some government agencies are useless. I mean, if you could do a survey and you ask people how much waste and uselessness is there in government, most people say, oh, a lot. There's a ton of it. Which agencies would you close? And they get a list. And everybody will want to close some agencies and leave others of it. But then they get very excited about the ones they love. And depending on who you ask, they have different ones they hate and different ones they love. So it varies like that. I don't think that those kind of concrete examples work. There have been so many good concrete examples in the history that people just ignore. And what you're going to see now, I do think it's useful to point out that the world is not ending because the government is shutting down. But to be able to go and say, look at this agency or that agency, is too concrete. I mean, one has to fight this battle on the level of, I mean, to me, it's all about ethics. It's all about morality because, as I explained, I think in the show I did last time about Alexandria something Cortez, unless we capture the moral high ground, it's all useless. As long as people are altruists, no number of concrete showing them that their political theory is wrong will help. So, yeah, by all means, do it to the same extent that teaching people free market economics is good. Show them the uselessness of certain government agencies, but don't expect that is a world changer or a life changer. Okay, Liberal Deutsch just jumped. Oh, there it is. Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh. Ugh, I hate royalty. I hate royalty. If I was in England, I would vote against the monarchy. I hate princes. I hate aristocrats. Just the whole idea of aristocracy is so offensive to my values. Anyway, the Duke of Edinburgh once said, everybody was saying we must have more leisure. Now they are complaining they are unemployed. What? So is life a quagmire unless you're the Duke? No, life's not a quagmire. I mean, when you're a subsistence farmer, or when you are working 100 hours a day in manual labor just to survive, then what you need is more leisure. More importantly than that, but you don't know that you need this. You need meaningful work. You need work that provides you with real value, with real challenges, work that can really enhance your self-esteem, work you can be proud of, work that's a reflection of your values and your passion. But you don't know that. What you know is you're working yourself to death. It's hard. You're getting nowhere. You'd love to sit on a beach somewhere, at least a little bit. But in a world where you love your work, where work is a passion, where work is fun, I mean, not all the time, not constantly, not every day, not in every situation, but generally, you enjoy your work, which is what you should all be doing. You should all find the work that you love. And sometimes you have to do something you're good at and develop the passion for it, and sometimes you have to pursue your passion and get good at it. But you don't want to, you know, don't pursue your passion if you're bad at that one activity. You know, you have to combine your skill level, your abilities with your passion. But you've got to love your work. You spend way too much time, way too much energy, way too much effort at work not to enjoy it. Then leisure becomes important, but not. Leisure is important as because you have to relax, you have to clear your mind, you have to. But it's not the goal. The goal is the work. So for Ayn Rand, having a purpose in life is one of the cardinal values. And leisure is not a purpose. Leisure is what you do to relax, to get away, to it's not a reason for living. It's not a purpose in life. So career is your purpose for most of us. I mean, child rearing can be your purpose. You can't have a hobby that's your purpose if you can't find a career that is such. But for most people, the career is their purpose. And therefore, your energy, your focus, your everything, your values should be oriented towards that purpose, towards your career. And leisure should be the break you take in between, because you can't literally spend all your life just pursuing one thing. I mean, that's why aesthetics are so important, art is so important, leisure is so important, the beach is so important. It's important to be able to just relax, to clear your mind, to think about something else, to experience emotionally the beauty of a sunset or the amazingness of a new TV show, to laugh. All those are really, really, really important in life. But they are just the what you're doing when you're not pursuing your purpose, when you're not pursuing your career. It's still true that most of your energy, most of your time, most of your focus should be on career. And I think this is why it's so hard to retire. It's so hard for people to retire. And even people who do retire, they usually find something to focus their minds on, some challenge, some hobby that they can really orient themselves towards. Okay, Kiako asks, can you explain how to debate, reject, need to help the poor, they need healthcare, an altruistic moral code that leftists always bring up in debates? I mean, I think you have to challenge it face on. I don't need to help the poor. The poor can help themselves. They don't need healthcare to be provided to them. They can take care of their own health care. I, for one, believe that poor people have the capacity to take care of themselves, have the capacity to provide health care for themselves if we get out of the way. Your focus as an individual out there is to live your life the best, to the best of your ability, the best life you can live. That is true. That is just as true for poor people. And what poor people need, just like we need, is the freedom to do that. And to give people the freedom to do that, we need to deregulate healthcare. To give people the freedom to do that, poor people the freedom to do that, we need to get rid of the minimum wage. To give poor people the freedom to do that, we need to get rid of business regulations. To give people, poor people, the freedom to do it, we need the state to do what it's supposed to do, which is protect individual rights and otherwise leave us alone. And if that happens, then the opportunities that the poor face are immense, and their lives will be better off to the extent that they take on the moral responsibility of making their lives good lives. That is a reframing of the debate, away from altruism, away from my responsibility to them. Now, if you want to shift the debate to altruism, you can ask why. Why do I need to help the poor? I need to help myself. I need to help my kids. I need to help those who I love and I care for. I need to take care of my life. And you could shift the debate to a moral debate about what should your focus be. But you can orient the political debate in a way that is egoistic without having to delve into the theory of morality. Although that might be your purpose and that would be fine. I would like to know your opinion about cooperative banks. This is Ignacio. I'm not sure I know what cooperative banks are. I mean, mutual banks, maybe you're talking about mutual banks. I mean, I don't have an opinion about any particular form of institution. I believe that's left for the marketplace. Cooperative banks, if they can compete with other banks, fine. I don't know that there's one particular legal form in which an organization needs to establish itself in order to do best. But I think there's nothing wrong with mutual banks if they can sustain themselves without the help of government. Today, it's very hard to evaluate that because all banks have deposit insurance, which is a massive subsidy which banks provide. All right, here's one more. Are the professors I spoke to about Ayn Rand and dismissed her as evil? Are the professors I spoke to about Ayn Rand and dismissed her, evil? All right. No, not necessarily. I think some are. But some of them might not know anything about her. Evil is a pretty strong word. Some of them might not know very much about her. Some of them might be just lazy. Some of them might be lazy thinkers or ignorant thinkers. Some of them might be immoral in that they evade certain aspects of their intellectual life in this context. And that, in that sense, they're bad people. But evil, I don't think anybody who dismisses Ayn Rand is evil, even intellectuals. I think many of them are immoral because I think of what they actually advocate for and the evasion involved in that. But to call somebody evil, they have to be more than that. Again, I differentiate between just calling somebody immoral, which is basically irrational, and calling somebody evil. They could be innocently ignorant or innocently mistaken about her ideas, which would not even rise to the level of immorality. Liberal Deutsch asks, since Aquinas, Christianity has been hijacking ancient Greece to sell it as its own. Couldn't objectivism now do the same to Christianity? That means for every popular Christian hymn, keep the nice melody but replace all the text. Hijacking Christianity. No, I mean, I don't know what that would mean, right? Because hijacking Christianity means hijacking faith. If all you mean is hijacking the music, sure, go for it. Let's do it. But hijacking Christianity really means hijacking faith. What Christianity did to ancients is they took reason and internalized it into aspects of what they were doing. They kept faith, but they, in order to give themselves credibility to some extent, they adopted reason in in the way in which they evaluate certain things, right? And I don't think you can do the other way around. I don't think there's anything in Christianity worth taking, except maybe the music. But the music is not uniquely Christian. That is what Christianity did very effectively, starting in the Renaissance. Well, really from the beginning, is used aesthetics, used art to bring people in. Right, to get people to come to church. Beautiful melodies. Come to church. Listen to beautiful melodies. Come to church. Look at the Sistine Chapel. Michelangelo did it. You know, inspire them through art. I definitely think objectivism can and must and should do that. This is why I think it's so crucial that objectivists have that they be great artists that people can look up to and people can admire, and that objectivism embrace aesthetics and embrace good art. For that, we need people who are experts in aesthetics to value what is good art. And then we need lots and lots and lots of great artists. That's what we need. The culture will not change. Here's a prediction. Culture will not change until we have lots and lots of great artists in music and sculpture and painting and poetry and literature. And we've already got a great artist right at our foundation. That is Ayn Rand, right? But it's not enough. We need lots of great artists. And until we have lots of great artists, we will not win. So that's not taking on Christianity. That's just, it's a tool Christianity used. And I think we use it too, in a sense that we have Ayn Rand's literature. But Christianity used very effectively, and I think should be used effectively. I think other philosophies have not used it effectively as consciously, because most philosophies, maybe with the exception of Marxism in certain periods. And Marxism, think about social realism as an art movement in the 1930s and 40s that both helped the Nazis and the communists spread their ideas. I mean, the communists were very, and Hitler, were very aware of using art to promulgate their ideas in the culture. And we need to do that, but not with the kind of authoritarian bent that, of course, the Nazis and the commies used. Okay, here's one more. Are you familiar with the effective altruism movement started by Will McCaskill? It seems like a good movement to me, but maybe they're going by a different definition of altruism. No, it's a horrible movement. So I'm very, very against the effective altruism movement. I am familiar with them. It really is all inspired by Peter Singer's work, the philosopher, academic philosopher, who is an ethicist, maybe the most influential ethicist alive today in the world. You know, the philosophers will have to tell us if that's true or not. And the idea of effective altruism, and maybe I get this wrong, so super K-pill, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong. But the idea behind this is that charity as a form of altruism, as a form of your moral duty to help the poor. So they completely accept that it's your moral duty, your moral responsibility to help the poor. So they completely accept the philosophical idea of altruism. And Peter Singer is horrible when it comes to this. He's really evil. You are not a moral person unless you're engaged in assisting the poor, assisting the needy. Their need is a claim against your life. Now, we want to make it more effective for you to do it. So how do we make it more effective to do it? We're going to get you to tithe. Automatically take 10% of your thing and put it away. We are going to create more effective and more efficient charities. We are going to create a mechanism to automatize your helping the needy, your being an effective altruist. But I'm not an altruist. I believe altruism is an evil ideology. I don't think you have a moral duty, a moral responsibility to help the poor, to help the needy. Your only moral responsibility is to you, to your life. And if in part of that you want to help some people, fine. But it's not what makes you a good person. It is not the essence of what makes you moral. I don't want to make people more effective altruists. I don't want to make them altruists. I want to get them get rid of altruism. I want to get rid of the idea that it's your moral duty to help the needy. I want to get rid of the idea that you should feel guilty for the fact that right now there are people dying of starvation in Africa. Because that's what Peter Singer wants you to feel. And Peter Singer wants to make it efficient for you to help people in Africa. He wants to make it efficient for you to, I don't give any charity to the needy. Zero. I mean, the real battle in the world today is not about need, it's about ideas. So I contribute a lot of money. Actually, the needy part is not completely true. I gave some contribution this year to the needy because I had to do, for a variety of reasons, I had to do some contribution in Puerto Rico. But mostly I contribute to ideas because that's the real issue. Charity is a minor virtue, and sometimes it's not a virtue at all. Sometimes it's a vice. It depends on your situation, condition, context. So, no, I think it's effective altruism is a terrible movement. Anything that legitimizes altruism, everything that makes altruism more efficient. It's like, I don't want government to be more efficient. I don't want to drive waste out of government. I want government to stop doing stuff. I want government to get out of my life. I want government to focus on just protecting individual rights. I don't want to just make bad stuff more efficient. I want to get rid of the bad stuff. I want to get rid of the bad things government does and keep only the good things. There's nothing good about altruism in the sense of that moral commitment to the need of others. That is wrong. Right. I mean, we need to talk more about altruism and talk more about why it's so evil and why it's so wrong. We'll do that in future shows. Do you believe Jesus was a real person or a myth? Have you ever read Richard Carrier's on the topic? No, I haven't read really anything on the topic, and I don't really care. It doesn't strike me as important. I was taught in school that he was a myth because that's what is taught was taught in Israel about Jesus, that he was a myth. But it doesn't matter. If he was a myth or wasn't a myth, what difference does it make? What matters is the influence, the story of Jesus, the supposed sayings and writings of Jesus have had on the world. And how do you combat that? So what's important is Christianity is a set of ideas and a set of mythologies that impact people. And you know, how do we address those ideas? How do we convince people of those ideas falsely? The man Jesus is uninteresting to me. I guess I'm curious historically, but I wouldn't read a book on it. I wouldn't watch a documentary on it. It's just not on all the things that interest me in life, whether Jesus was real or not is not up there at all. Okay. Liberal Deutsch, we're going to make your question, super chat question, the last one. Otherwise, I'm going to be here all day. Although this is fairly profitable. Maybe I should be here all day. Okay, here's one from Ignacio. I would like to hear some comments on the performance of the EU banking sector during the sub-crisis. during the subprime crisis. How is it now? I mean, the European banking is pretty bad. It's always been bad, primarily because it's so heavily, heavily, heavily regulated. Deutsche Bank has always been somewhat of a arm of the German government and heavily regulated as a consequence. One of the things that people don't talk about the financial crisis is the fact that European banks before the financial crisis were regulated by a European banking regulations, actually global banking regulations. A lot of U.S. banks fell under these regulations, Basel regulations. And at the time there were Basel II, now they're talking about Basel III. Set of regulations. One of the things those regulations did, I'll just give you this one anecdote, is that they defined mortgage-backed securities, CDOs. CDOs are derivatives off of mortgage-backed securities, like packages of mortgage-backed securities. They defined mortgage-backed securities that were rated AAA as riskless securities that did not require the banks to carry any capital against it. So one of the real mysteries when the crisis happened was why did the European banks have so much mortgage-backed securities, American mortgage-backed securities, why were they investing so heavily in American mortgage-backed security? And the reason is because the regulators basically drove them to do that by completely mistakenly and out of any market context, rating those securities or defining those securities as risk-free securities and not requiring them to keep any capital against them. That's the kind of ways in which government regulations cause financial crises like the one we saw in 2008. And since European banking is as heavily regulated now as it was back then, if not more so, European banks are in bad shape. I'll give you some other examples. One more example, the Greek crisis. Why did Germany spend so much time, effort, money to bail out Greece? Why does it care so much about Greece? Because Deutsche Bank held Greek bonds, huge amounts of Greek bonds. So by bailing out Greece, they bailed out Deutsche Bank. And, you know, you see this pattern over and over again. Now, why do governments, why do banks hold so much debt of governments? Because they're required to. The regulators, in a sense, force them into doing it. Because that's how governments finance themselves. It's been like that for hundreds of years. Government finance themselves by forcing the banking sector to buy their debt. Anyway, so the banking sector in Europe is not in good shape. I don't know in terms of valuations because they've probably come down quite a bit. But in terms of just underlying fundamentals, I don't think they're in very good shape. And they're not as – the banking sector in the U.S. in some ways is in better shape, is more capitalized from what I understand. All right, Liberal Deutsch asks, making good romantic documentaries about the Renaissance can be cheap. Just mix bedtime story kind of narratives with art images and classical music. Sheila Roche's The New Dark Age. Maybe, in that case, go do it. And I encourage all of you to go do it. But that's only part of the problem. The other part of the problem is how do you get anybody to watch them? I think I've told you this, Liberal Deutsch, before. I mean, I've been involved in making a couple of documentaries. And, it wasn't cheap to make them, but I could raise the money for that. But then how do you market them? How do you get anybody to watch them? So it's I find that the challenge. And the more radical the ideas you present in the documentary, the more difficult it is to get. The big channels, the Netflix of the world and those places, even if they carry them, it's one among 1,000 documentaries. Why should anybody watch that one? I find the marketing after making the documentary more difficult. And getting them on television is very, very difficult because the television channels don't want them. Don't want them. All right. Thanks, everybody. Generally, I see a lot of you in the chat asking questions. The best way to ask a question, the only way really for me to guarantee me answering it, is to use the Super Chat feature. So you can plan on doing that next time we have a show. Next show will be tomorrow, I think, tomorrow evening. That's Wednesday, January 2nd at 7 p.m. East Coast time. So look forward to visiting you with then, and then probably the day after that as well. So the next 2 days, there will be shows, your Ron Brooks shows. Let the world know. I'll also be releasing short videos every morning, 9 a.m. East Coast time. We'll be releasing a short video pretty much every day now. So look forward to that. Share the videos, particularly the short ones. The short ones, you have no excuse. Those are the kind of videos that people share. Again, the most important parameter, the most important way in which to get the ideas out there is using social media is through the share feature. So please share them with your networks and get the word out there. I mean, the chat is incredibly active. I really appreciate that. I can't follow it, so I apologize if I miss some interesting discussions. I just can't follow it because there's too much going on, and there's a lot of super chat questions. All right, everybody. You know, as I said, have a great, great, happy new year. Do what I said in the beginning of the show. A lot of you joined late, but spend the next few days thinking about how to make your life better. Your life. Forget about the world. Forget about politics. Forget about Elizabeth Warren. Forget about Donald Trump. Just focus on you. What do you need to do? And to do that, I highly recommend that in the next few days, you all read The Objectivist Ethics by Ayn Rand. It's available online for free at the Ayn Rand Institute website on the campus site. Read The Objectivist Ethics and contemplate, think about how to make your life better in 2019, better than it's ever been. All right. Action Jackson asks, is it an audible? Absolutely, it's an audible. It's the first essay in The Virtue of Selfishness, which I know is available on Audible. If you want to support this show, and I very much appreciate that, you can still do so on Patreon. But if you want to avoid Patreon, and I'm going to move out of Patreon at some point in the next month or so, if you want to avoid using Patreon so there's not the hassle of switching afterwards, you can support me now on paypal.me/YaronBrookShow, paypal.me/YaronBrookShow. And as I mentioned early on in the show, I am looking for a WordPress programmer. So if you are a WordPress programmer, if you are very proficient, very efficient, very quick on WordPress, please contact me at Yaron@YaronBrookShow.com. Yaron@YaronBrookShow.com. Talk to you all tomorrow. Have a great new year and have a great evening. Bye, everybody.